From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's Uncle Sam to the rescue, but what is the long-term fallout for your mortgage or your community? We're talking about an unprecedented takeover. The federal government has seized the reins at mortgage giants Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Together, the companies hold nearly half of the country's mortgages. And here to break down the bailout and other economic news, we've got Keith Reed. He's a business reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and he blogs for BET's finance page, Dollar Out of 15 Cents. Keith, how are you?
How you doing, Farai?
Good. Now give me a really quick hit on what these two entities are and how they've worked with the government until now.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are basically publicly traded companies that have been backed by the government for some time. And their mission is basically to keep fluidity in the mortgage market by buying mortgages from banks, thus allowing them to continue to lend money to people who need to borrow money to buy a house. In other words, if I'm a bank, I know that if I, give you a mortgage, Fannie and Freddie will buy that mortgage from me, and thus I'll get cash that I can then lend out to somebody else. So that's what Fannie and Freddie's mission has always been.
So what prompted this bailout, and what's it going to do for people on the ground, not just people in government and people in business?
Well, what prompted the bailout was initially, this kind of go back to about a year, Fannie and Freddie have lost about $14 billion over the last year. Again, these are publicly traded companies, so shareholders have been worried about the companies for a while. But the bigger impact on the national economy is really what prompted the bailout. When you take a look at the fact that Fannie and Freddie actually purchase about half the nation's mortgages, that could have a huge impact if that company fails on the national economy. What happened over this past weekend was that the Treasury actually discovered that some accounting irregularities in the books of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to make it made it look like their books were actually stronger than they were, when in fact their books were weaker. Their financials were a lot weaker than anyone suspected, and the federal government stepped in to take over both of those entities.
So when you think about particularly African-American neighborhoods, you've got a lot of neighborhoods, and you know, not just black neighborhoods, where you'll see for sale signs. Sometimes now you're starting to see abandoned houses. We've even heard stories about how abandoned houses then produce crime because people will base out of those houses. Is this going to really help people at the grassroots level?
It's going to help some people at the grassroots level. As with anything in the economy, it's going to take a long time, or at least some months, for the real fallout from this to be known. What it does mean in the immediate term is that some banks will be able to lend more money, again, because Fannie and Freddie is going to get a cash infusion from the government to continue their work of buying mortgages from the banks. And so that should ease up credit. It should also make it potentially a little bit easier and a little bit cheaper to borrow, because banks, when they're not taking as much risk, then they can lower some mortgage rates, things like that. I don't know that it's necessarily going to clean up any neighborhood where you got people going into an abandoned house in Free Basin or selling drugs or you know, abandoned houses, that sort of thing. I don't know that this move is going to have that immediate impact on the ground in neighborhoods that are already blighted.
What about at this upper level? What about what's happened in the stock markets and in the international community as a ramification of this?
Well, actually, there's two sort of interesting or almost ironic impacts from this. Investors broadly, both in the U.S. and around the world, are happy about this, again, because the federal backing or the federal takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac brings a little bit of, brings some liquidity back to the U.S. lending markets. It will also it'll make that mortgage market a little bit more solid and give some clarity to what might happen to the housing picture over the next, say, you know, 12 to 18 months in going from there. But individual investors, I talked to a friend of mine up in Boston this morning who owns shares of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, are not going to be happy, because they're going to be in a position where, you know, these stocks have lost a ton of value. The hit that they're taking on the equities markets because of the government takeover, because of the fact that they've lost $14 billion, because of the accounting regularities. If you are actually an investor who is a shareholder of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you are probably not too happy right now.
All right, let's turn to something else that isn't going to make people happy. We're talking about the unemployment rate. 5-year high, 6.1% overall, more than 10% for African Americans. What does this bad news do to the economy, in addition to obviously hurting people on a very real, very personal level?
I think it's a result of what we've already seen in the economy, more so than a cause. I mean, when you start to get into these economic cycles, the economy sort of goes into a tailspin where low productivity, where higher interest rates, where mortgages aren't being made. Those things start to begat lesser investments by companies, which begats lower wages, which begats inflation, which begats higher unemployment. And the cycle starts to repeat, because then when you have higher unemployment, people can't buy, then they can't borrow, then they can't purchase houses, they can't build, that sort of thing. I think we're just sort of in the middle of that swirling, circling kind of, to use an unfortunate sort of hurricane kind of analogy. We're in the middle. We're sort of at the eye of the storm, where all of these things are just swirling around each other, and we're not sure when any one of them is going to show enough signs of life to make that stop.
When you think about, I mean, and you wear a couple of different hats, obviously, you know, the macro and the micro. What is it that really will allow people in certain job markets where there just aren't a lot of jobs to thrive? What kind of advice would you give if you had a buddy who had lost a job and obviously things are tight and there's not a lot of folks in some communities? In others, it's different, but in some communities, not a lot of folks even have jobs to give out.
I think that there's always an opportunity. I mean, if you want to look at the silver lining, whenever the economy goes into a tailspin, you do see an uptick in entrepreneurship. And clearly for an entrepreneur trying to start in this market where it's difficult to borrow and when a lot of people don't have the kind of savings that they need, that is going to be a particularly tough path. But you do see in cycles of economic downturn, when more people are losing jobs, you do start to see more business creation, if not job creation. And I think we'll start to see the impact of that maybe 4 or 5 years down the road. Some of the other things that people may consider, I mean, if you're in a market where jobs are tight, you may want to consider going back and getting some training, starting to look at some of the areas of the economy that we're going
to
see burgeoning.
She's
such as
green
technologies,
but without that other guest.
those sorts of things. Green technology, biomedical technologies, those sorts of pursuits are still going to be very much popular and still going to be in need over the next 10 to 20 years. So people are going to start to go back for training. So I think those are that's the type of advice that I would give to people if they're out there looking for a job right now and can't find one.
So, Keith, you know, one of the stories that we tracked over the last week, obviously politics was the big story, but also we had Hurricane Gustav, and we spoke with a woman named Thena Robinson. She was just one of the many people who were on the move. Now those people are returning. When you think about the economic ramifications, what kind of things do communities that are just lifting up again need to think about in terms of infrastructure, and what do individuals need to think about?
In terms of a community, when you've got some of the devastation that a hurricane can bring, you're looking at first an initial ground response. You're talking about the grim task of maybe rescue and recovery that we saw go on for a couple of weeks during Katrina. Then after you get to that point, when you're beyond rescue and recovery, you're talking about the cost of getting basic services to people. People who have survived and who are returning need food, they need water, they need electricity, they need basic transportation, they need a way to make ends meet until their jobs reopen. Over the long term, then you're talking about, depending on the level and the extent of the damage, then you have to take into consideration what happens to individual families' wages and costs of living. I think, again, back to Katrina, what happened in New Orleans, if you spent any time down there, you would see that many of the apartments that didn't used to cost as much, many of the housing units that didn't cost that much pre-hurricane, skyrocketed because there had been so much damage done that there weren't many places to live, and supply and demand dictated that. Insurance companies didn't want to pay the claims that many people filed, and people had paid for years into their premiums on their policies. So you do have a lot of rebuilding, and of course that's going to be commensurate with the level of damage that's done by any particular storm.
There are a lot of people who just barely recovered from Hurricane Katrina. Now they have got to face additional cost from Gustav, if only the cost of evacuating and returning and not being able to work. There was a lot of talk about what insurance did and didn't do. Do you have any suggestions on how people in hurricane zones should look at insurance or other factors that might help them looking forward?
Unfortunately, in many cases, it may be too late. I mean, if you were to go back 3 years, I would tell anybody that to get the maximum coverage that you can afford, because what we've seen is that many insurance companies or many of the insured in those areas didn't carry the kinds of riders that they need. So you may have had a house that was destroyed by a flood and discovered that your hurricane insurance policy only covered wind damage but didn't have a rider for flood damage. So that would be number one. The reason why I say it may be too late to do that is that even in the case where someone can now afford the maximum premiums for all the riders that they need to take care of their property in the event of a storm, is that many of these insurance companies have simply stopped writing the kinds of policies that people really need to be protected. They took so many losses in the insurance business with Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. This is going to be, appears to be, another big season for storms, and we're not out of the woods yet. There's another one bearing down potentially on Florida and the Gulf, that many of these insurance companies simply stopped writing policies for hurricanes that can protect people who live in these areas.
Very quickly, if you're in an area that doesn't seem to get severe weather, should you pay attention to severe weather policies quickly?
Yeah, you should, because just because you don't live in a hurricane zone doesn't mean that severe weather isn't possible. You can get snow damage, wind damage, tornado damage, rain damage, flood damage. Weather is unpredictable, and you should absolutely make sure that you're covered to the maximum that you need to be in your area.
Keith, always great to talk to you. Thanks.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
That's News and Notes contributor Keith Reed. He is a business reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer.